Hello, and welcome to 18 Groups podcast on systematic internalization under MiFID II, brought to you from our RegTech Summit in London on the 4th of October 2018. The podcast focuses on the state of play in the MiFID II systematic internalizer regime, considers why firms decide to become SIs, and outlines the challenges and solutions of regulatory reporting. Listen to our speaker, Peter Moss, CEO of the SmartStream Reference Data Utility, to find out more.
I'm going to talk a little bit about the topic of systematic internalization, really about sort of where it's going and what's happening over the next few months. This is a topic that we covered in a white paper that you'll see actually on the seats or in the desks in front of you, so feel free to take it away. So, where to start? I don't have to tell any of you, I don't think, that MiFID II was a massive undertaking for everybody. I don't know about you guys, but I didn't have a Christmas last year. I'm hoping this year will be different, but I guess that might depend on what happens with Brexit, but we'll see. But I want to take it back to actually the topic that came up on the last panel. The last panel, people were saying, someone in the audience asked a question around, we focus so much on the problems, we kind of lose sight of the actual overarching sort of goal of this, right? And of course, if you look back at the original text for MiFID II, the goal was very much around transparency. Now, in the equity markets, I think transparency was always pretty good, right? So what MiFID brings, I think, is a focus on transparency for the fixed income and OTC markets. And of course, the systematic internalizers who actually trade and create most of that liquidity are actually pivotal to making sure that that transparency actually arrives. And how do we do that in the MiFID markets? Well, we do it through pre-trade price publication, an absolute requirement for liquid instruments, for post-trade reporting, and of course, for transaction reporting and best execution reports. Now, my focus today is actually going to be on very much the landscape, how the regime is actually unfolding, and if you've lived and breathed MiFID and are still living and breathing MiFID over the last sort of 12 months, you may not learn a huge amount new, but hopefully I'll give you a few insights into what's happening in the market and how it's evolving. Now, I don't think anybody really thought it was going to finish on the 3rd of January, right? There was enough lack of clarity that it was pretty clear that there was going to be an evolving story going on here. And I'm not going to read all of the things on that slide there. You may struggle to from where you are in the various positions around the room as well. But fundamentally, we've seen an evolving mix of things. DVC, bond liquidity, best execution, the no LEI, no trade finally came in July, and we started at the beginning of September to see the mandatory SI regime come in. Now, 1st of September was intended to be the date when actually anyone that was trading more than a certain volume of instruments in a particular instrument or instrument set would be mandated to become a systematic internalizer. And that was going to be across all instruments, all trading. ESMA came out sort of about a month before and said, we actually can't get the volume data that we need for the OTC derivative markets in particular, and so we're going to hold off on that. But we're going to go live with equities and fixed income, which happened on the 1st of September. Now, what does that actually mean? Well, I'll come on to that on the next slide, but fundamentally, this thing is still evolving. And the interesting thing is the OTC derivatives now comes in on the 1st of March next year, about 4 or 5 weeks before I guess we'll know what will happen with Brexit as well, right? So there are a number of things going on that I think means that MiFID will run and run for a while. a number of us actually who've been sort of working in the MiFID space for a while are now sort of watching with bated breath what the FCA are going to come out with around Brexit in particular, and what that will mean in terms of potentially dual jurisdictions, different data sources, and so on. And I think it's going to be a fascinating few months. So, coming back to the basics, I talked just now around the fact that the systematic internalizer is at the heart of all of this, right? So, the pre-trade price transparency, the publishing of quotes before you trade, so that you can see in the market what those prices actually are. The publishing of post-trade reports within 15 minutes of a trade actually happening, and the transaction reports within 24 hours after that, all lend themselves towards the transparency, the key being around quote publishing and trade publishing. Now, in theory, that brings a whole load of new data to the market, right? But the reality is, of course, that data is being published through, I think, realistically, probably about 9 APAs. And as we all know, the output from those APAs isn't yet at a point where it's easy to bring together. But I think that will change as the world moves on. So what do you need to do as an SI in order to actually create that pre-trade quote and that post-trade report? Well, the reality is you actually need to do a little bit of work around your sales trader workflow. Now, for equities, everybody actually more or less had done that. But I'm going to come on in a little bit to talk a little bit about how that has to happen and what the implications of that actually are. As I said, up until the 1st of September, the SA regime was voluntary. And we saw about 75 systematic internalizers active in the market. There were a larger number registered with ESMA, but in terms of active SIs, it was probably about 75. We saw a growing number of SIs actually come onto the market and start to become active as the 1st of September date loomed. And I can pretty much guarantee that as we get closer to the 1st of March date, you will see another influx of SIs. I think there are 130 plus currently registered with ESMA, but not all of those are actually active as systematic internalizers today. How do I know this? Well, because we actually run with the APA community a listing of all of the SIs and the instruments that they're actually providing SI services in, and a little bit more on that later on. So who are the SIs? Well, I don't think this is going to be much of a surprise to the audience here, right? But you've obviously got the large international brokers, the bulge bracket firms, actually very quick to come out and sort of declare voluntary opt-in for SI status, quite often literally across the board. And we see a lot of the larger firms actually have done that. For them, I think it was very much a competitive thing. They wanted to make life easy for their customers. They wanted to differentiate themselves perhaps from other players in the market who were less clear and certain about what they were trying to achieve. We've seen a number of high-volume intermediaries come onto the market and declare themselves as SIs. I was at an A-team event actually a couple of weeks back, sitting on a panel with a couple of guys from, I think it was Citadel and Tower. And they are very clear. They're high-volume players, and they think there's a competitive advantage in being a systematic internalizer, very much in the equity space. So nothing revolutionary there, but so you see a number of these high-volume intermediaries actually sort of becoming systematic internalizers as well. The more interesting space, I think, is actually the regional and sort of market specialists, because that's the area where firms are going to get caught, because they are high-volume players in relatively niche markets. And that's the area where you won't necessarily have seen the mad dash for voluntary opt-in, but as the 1st of March date sort of kicks in and you start to get people focusing on, let's say, interest rate swaps for Australian dollar and euro, you'll start to see some of the Australian banks who are specialists in that kind of a market start to worry about their systematic internalizer status, their need to actually sort of move and get the infrastructure in place. And I think that's true for a lot of sort of the extraterritorial markets that trade effectively with the European Union. So Australia, Canada, US, although US is served by a lot of the large global players anyway, Japan, and a lot of other firms, a lot of other regions around the world will actually sort of start, I think, to pay real attention to this. The thing is, you actually don't have a huge amount of time when that actually happens. When the volumes get published, I think it's going to be about a month before the 1st of March, you have 2 weeks, essentially, to comply. And so if you're not thinking about this now, and you're in one of those firms that is likely to get caught, you better go and start doing some homework. Because this is a relatively brutal timeline, 2 weeks. So, bottom line, if you're a specialist, and actually I have no idea who's in the audience, but if you are or if you know firms that actually are likely to get caught by this, it's worthwhile just sort of giving them a hint that they're going to have to do some work here. So, what do you need to do to become a systematic internalizer, to actually fulfill the obligations that are required around this? Well, truth is, you have a range of different obligations that you need to actually sort of comply with. First and foremost, if you are the first to trade an instrument in Europe, you need to register it. You need to register that instrument with ESMA, and of course, if it's an OTC derivative, you'll need to reach out to ANA, the ANA DSB, and actually go and get an ISIN. Pretty important. And actually, in the OTC derivative space, that's not going to be an unusual situation, right? I mean, you're going to find a lot of firms who are actually trading new instruments and looking to actually sort of register those instruments before they trade. Secondly, you've got to get access to all of the essential reference data for that instrument. You need to know whether the instrument is liquid. You need to know what the various thresholds actually are around that instrument and use those thresholds to determine whether or not you should be publishing a quote before you actually trade. If your order that you're processing is actually a large order, then the threshold may mean you don't have to publish the quote. Similarly, on the trade report, you're going to need access to a lot of those thresholds as well, right? So it's a complex set of data. You need to make sure that you actually have access to it. Of course, if you're a regional player and you're only actually sort of becoming an SI for a small number of instruments, then this is a very narrow thing that you're going to have to get access to. And you probably don't want to go to ESMA and get all of the data that is required. You just need the data for the instruments that you're actually going to be paying attention to. Obviously, you've got to execute the trade. You've got to report the trade afterwards. You need to know what kind of an organization you're trading with, because actually the trade reporting regime is one-sided. If you are trading with a venue, the venue reports. If you're trading with a systematic internalizer, the systematic internalizer reports. If you're trading with a MiFID investment firm and you are not a systematic internalizer, then you have to understand which of you is going to report, and it will be the seller in that particular instance. So understanding the role of your counterparty, critical as well. And then, of course, you're going to report the trade. You're probably going to use an APA to do that, and you'll need to do that in near real time. and finally file the transaction report within the next 24 hours. On top of that, and an area where actually not a lot of focus has been paid as of yet, at least based on the conversations that I've had across a wide range of firms, ESMA stipulates that you need to put a control framework in place. They want you to be able to confirm that the trades that you've been reporting and the transactions that you've been sending to the regulator are actually the things that you traded, and that control framework needs to basically confirm all the way through your own organization, but also needs to confirm that the APA and the ARM are doing the things that they need to on your behalf as well. Still not a massive focus area at this particular point. Why? I think because everybody is still waiting for the basic sort of regulatory mechanisms to bed down. And I think once enforcement actions start to flow, then I think this control framework will start to become a much more focused area. It's an area where we've done a little bit of work. I'll give a little bit of a sort of a an advert to RegTech, who are out there with a booth. We've done a little bit of work with them around putting in place a control framework capability with to reconcile trades or transactions, and to actually determine whether or not the trade that you have just done needs to be reported. What is actually changing your sales trade workflow and getting access to this data actually mean? Well, clearly that's unreadable from where everybody is, but the point I wanted to make here was that actually getting access to the data isn't particularly straightforward, and managing your changes to your trader workflow is not necessarily straightforward either. In my experience, what we've seen is actually trading firms prefer to focus on the workflow changes, and then they'll use a data vendor of some sort. This happens to be our architecture for our data provision, but actually, I'm sure inside Thomson Reuters or Bloomberg or any one of the other data vendors, you'll find similar infrastructure pulling data from ESMA, blending it together with ANA and Glyph data, and actually sending that data out to customers. We believe that you have to have a set of APIs there to help, particularly in the OTC derivatives space, and we actually have integration with the ANA DSB to simplify that approach for our customers as well. Our customers, I should stress, are a combination of APIs and systematic internalizers. So it's complicated. If you're a firm that is only going to be a systematic internalizer for a small number of instruments, get help. Get some help from an external party to actually make it easy for yourselves, because it's not worth going through the kind of effort that the tier one firms went to, where they threw money at this just for a few instruments that you're going to have to actually become a systematic internalizer for. So a little bit on the state of play. I'm conscious of time as well, actually. How long have I got? 10 minutes. Okay, thank you. So a little bit on the state of play. So clearly the market landscape is a bit of a work in progress at the moment. I think for anybody that's been involved in this whole area, the data quality has been less than perfect, but it is starting to get better. You're starting to see regulators and ESMA step in and advise firms and cajole firms to actually make sure that the quality of what they're reporting is correct. We collect data from ESMA on a daily basis. I'm sure a number of you in the audience possibly do as well. 50% of the time, the files are late. And so clearly ESMA is still struggling a little bit with actually getting that data out the door in a timely fashion. But I think it's actually probably going to get better as things sort of settle down. And of course, data completeness is mixed as well, right? If you talk to anybody from the ANA DSB, and you can ask a question on the panel in a minute, then actually you'll find out very quickly that there's 13 million plus ISINs registered, and only about sort of 1.5 million of those have made it into FERDs, into the ESMA database. So there's still a bit of a gap there. Not necessarily all of them need to be registered, although I think technically they probably do. SI implementation, well, some firms are in very good shape. They really are. I happen to have three shareholders on for my organization, Goldman's, JP Morgan, and Morgan Stanley, who threw lots of money at this. And they're in pretty good shape, and I would imagine a lot of the other tier one firms are as well. But there are a lot of firms out there that have tactical solutions in place. And that's okay. It got them through the initial sort of starting point. But if you are a RegTech supplier, or you're running an infrastructure that is tactical, this is a massive opportunity, I think, for a much more strategic approach. MiFID is not going to go away. It's something that actually needs to be operational for the next few years, probably the next 20 or 30 years. And an infrastructure that can last that long, I think, is critically important. So tactical solutions get you to a certain point. I think, actually, this is the sort of thing where strategic approach is probably helpful as well. A lot of firms still have manual processes in place. We're talking to a number of organizations that actually literally are, as they receive an RFQ from a customer, manually creating reference data, and then actually quoting a price and doing the trade. Clearly not the most timely of processes, right? And there's got to be opportunities for automation there. My point here, I think, more than anything else, given that this is a RegTech conference, is there is a lot of opportunity here to actually improve the underlying infrastructure that a lot of firms are using. And I would stress that opportunity is probably just beginning in a number of instances. I talked a little bit about control frameworks earlier on. This is just Europe, right? Other regulators are starting to look at what they can do. They've seen Dodd-Frank start at sort of one extreme of a spectrum. They've seen MiFID play out at, I would say, completely the opposite end of the spectrum in terms of detail, definitional sort of specifics and so on. And I have no idea what the regulators around the rest of the world are going to do in terms of where they're going to place themselves on that spectrum. But expect them to start to look at the sort of transparency that is being created. And then, of course, there is Brexit. There really is a lot of uncertainty still around exactly what that means in the MiFID space. We're already doing some work with the APA community around what the impact might be there. But I have to say it's not at all clear at this particular point in time. I've spoken to two or three people already today who are actively working with the Treasury and the FCA to look at ways in which this can be resolved, but there isn't a clear statement of where all of this is going yet. So I think you have to pay attention and watch this space. As I said on a previous slide, we think that actually at some point downstream there will be close to 150 plus systematic internalizers. That's a more or less a 50% increase, perhaps not quite. And that will be a lot of firms. We're seeing German Landesbank, for example, actually sort of coming into the mix and becoming systematic internalizers. We're seeing a lot of smaller niche organizations, very specific to a particular market, who are actually now declaring themselves as SIs. As I said earlier, navigating this is hard. The market is now becoming quite sort of fragmented in terms of who's a systematic internalizer and what services they actually provide. And the listing that we've developed with the APAs is really the only way of actually understanding the landscape. So if you are a systematic internalizer and need to track who should be reporting the trades, you or your counterparty, you need this data. Every one of the systematic internalizers in Europe is using this data in some shape or form that we collected with the APAs. Every one of the APAs that has a rules engine that as part of their service is using this data as well. And this data is now available and being looked at by a number of buy-side firms as a way of actually determining who is providing what services, what sort of brokers should I be working with, who is likely to be able to provide the liquidity that I need in fixed income markets, who is likely to be able to provide best execution. And as I think we may touch on in the panel in a minute, best execution is not necessarily that straightforward in those markets. I think everybody kind of understands what it is in equities. It's not so straightforward in fixed income. So if you've got a large trade that you need to put away and you can't get liquidity from one place, understanding who might have inventory, who might have liquidity, actually is pretty critical. And just to be clear how we collect that data, because it wasn't data that was provided by the regulator. It's a process, a daily process of collecting data from all of the systematic internalizers, working with the APA community, bringing that data in at 5 o'clock every day, consolidating it into one set of files, and then sending that data back out again to all of the APAs and all of the systematic internalizers. It actually adds up to about 1.3 million records at the moment. Combination of ISINs, sort of fixed income records, and COFIA-based classification data to define who is an SI in what. And that's available on a subscription basis as well as available to the SI community as part of their contribute to get back free approach. And that's it, really. I'm not going to sort of say much more. Fundamentally, I think I've probably talked about an area where you all know quite a bit. I hope I've given you a little bit more color around exactly how this market is evolving. Is there time for questions? Are there any questions? Okay, excellent. Do we know how many buy-sides have become SIs? I guess it depends on how you define a buy-side, right? So I don't think many buy-side firms are really sort of considering it, to be perfectly honest. You get the multi sort of functional sort of organizations that are both asset managers and brokers. But this isn't something that a buy-side firm really needs to sort of get involved in. Go on.
Yeah, no, I'm quite interested in your thoughts for buy sides and the rest of the market who aren't systematic internalizers and who will not reach the thresholds to in any way become a systematic internalizer. What do you see as being the main implications of the SI regime on the wider market in terms of how firms need to adapt their best execution procedures or their smart order routing or any of that kind of stuff, because this is a big change to the market, but the systematic internalizers themselves are only a small part of that. So
I mean you're right, they are a small part of the equity world where there are listed products, right? I think the major impact is much more in the OTC space, in the fixed income world, and in the OTC derivatives sort of area, where historically there's been much less transparency, and the whole smart order routing thing has not really sort of played out, right? So I think I'm not sure this has a massive impact in the equity world, to be perfectly honest. But I think when you're looking at sort of fixed income strategies, it's an altogether different story, and I think that's where it starts to become more interesting. And then it's actually really a question of how do you execute a trade. So, for example, if you are wanting to trade a Spanish bond, maybe that's an easy example, but you may just naturally go to your sort of your standard set of brokers and actually sort of and trade with them, and they'll just lay off a trade to someone in Spain. Well, I think with the systematic internalizer market, you can get much more visibility around who's actually providing the liquidity as the underlying sort of firm, and you can go straight there. So there's an optimization there that actually might make it easier to actually sort of reduce spreads a little bit and maybe provide sort of access to liquidity in a much more straightforward way. So, I mean, that's one thing. I think the best execution sort of regime is not specifically SI focused, it's brokers generally. But the reality is the SIs are the ones that are likely to have the volume. And particularly when the mandatory regime kicks in, I think that's a very good indication as to who's likely to be able to give you what you need. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to our podcast on the systematic internalizer regime under MiFID II. For more content on RegTech from A-Team Group, visit our website at datamanagementreview.com. You can also sign up on the website for our next RegTech Summit, which will be in New York City on the 15th of November and is free of charge for financial institutions.